Okay, well, the world economic crisis poses sharply the need for a socialist alternative. It's brought economic devastation on a global scale, you know, throwing people out of work, out of their homes, savaging public services and destroying industry. Now, the depravity of the capitalist system has been on display for many years now in a way, in the form of, you know, particularly the US wars in the Middle East. But I think the economic crisis poses the questions much more sharply. It brings the class divide and the class struggle to the centre of politics. It raises fundamental questions about the way society is organised, about the market, about the profit system, and so on. Now, there's no doubt that the crisis has been and will continue to be a disaster for workers. But it also presents a historic challenge to rebuild the left after the collapse of Stalinism and all of the capitalist triumphalism that went with that. Their system has suffered an enormous blow, and in and of itself, this raises the question of the socialist reorganisation of society. Okay, so this is going to be a long, drawn-out and protracted crisis. But I don't think we can hope that the system will just collapse of its own accord. If it's not challenged in the next few years, the ruling class will pulverise working-class living standards. And we're seeing this in Greece at the moment. The austerity measures being imposed there are viewed by the ruling class as a blueprint for the whole of Europe. The bankers, the industrialists, and the politicians are keenly watching on to see if the Greek government can set the ball rolling for vicious cutbacks across the continent. So we need resistance to this. We need to rebuild a left. But really, in terms of how we do this, we need to start with an honest assessment of where the left is around the world today. I think you can see fairly clearly that the parties of mainstream social democracy, the historic organisations of the left, are in a historic crisis. There was a widespread expectation in 2008 that these parties would benefit from, you know, the huge discrediting of the system, in particular of neoliberal policies. But actually, they haven't benefited. In fact, if you look at last year's European elections, which is probably one of the best guides of where things are at, you saw that instead of the social democratic parties going forward, actually it was the right that benefited and the social democratic vote collapsed. So just to give people a few figures they might may be familiar with or not. In Germany, the SPD won only 21% of the vote. In Austria, it was only 23%. In Italy, 26% for the social democrats there. In Britain, Labour came third with only 16% of the vote. And, you know, the Labour Party now, with the upcoming elections in Britain, is in serious trouble. In Sweden, it was 24% for the Social Democrats. In France, 16.5%. And it's not just a matter of the Social Democratic parties losing votes. Party members have been quitting in droves. If you look at Britain, in the 90s, when Thatcher looked looked like they were set for defeat, the British Labour Party increased its membership by 50% to 400,000 members. But over the period of Labour in office under Blair, the Labour Party membership went down to just 150,000 today. In Germany, the SPD, which was in office from 1998 to 2009, saw its membership shrink from 780,000 to 540,000. And really, those two parties are two of the biggest social democratic parties in the world in terms of, you know, having maintained a mass membership. In a whole series of other countries, the figures are much lower. In Australia, ALP membership is at probably an all-time low. Mark Latham, in his excellent book, it is excellent, people should read it, estimated, the sort of honesty of the defeated, estimated that the Labor Party only has, in real terms, a few thousand members today, and that the overwhelming bulk of them are union officials, people who work for the party, and so on. You know, a few students, a few pensioners, very few workers. So, social democracy. Obama, I suppose, even though he's not a social democrat in the traditional sense, seemed for a period after he got elected to be the exception to this pattern. You know, initially, he was hugely popular. We've talked this weekend about, you know, the hope that, that his election sparked. But now we see that Obama's in trouble, you know, despite what's happened with the healthcare and so on, you know, giving him some more stability. But really we're seeing, you know, deep increasing disillusionment on the left with Obama, people who voted for him, and a vicious rebellion led by the right, led by the same forces that caused the economic disaster in the first place. So that example of an exception on the mainstream left is, you know, starting to turn around. Okay, so why haven't the Social Democrats been able to benefit from this crisis when you think, you know, it should be the obvious thing that would happen? I think fundamentally it's because they are so deeply tied into the capitalist system. Social democracy in almost every country is fully implicated in the policies that led to the crisis, which they have when in government overseen for the last 30 years in most places. In this period, they abandoned the reformist project, you know, the idea that capitalism ought to be reformed in the interests of workers, and became as slavish a followers of the interests of capital as are the openly bourgeois or capitalist parties. So that's one factor. I think there's another as well to do with the crisis, and that is that the capitalist class has not given them a great deal of room to move. If you think of the last two great upheavals in the system, they saw a fundamental rethink in the ruling class's strategic orientation. So in the Great Depression, Keynesianism came to replace laissez-faire economics. And when the recession of the mid-1970s hit, the new philosophy of monetarism, which later morphed into neoliberalism, led to a total restructuring of the world system. And there's just simply no equivalent to this this time around so far. What we've seen instead from the ruling class is an extraordinary level of pragmatic adaption. So free market principles, neoliberalism, were totally ignored in the bailout period as governments, you know, desperately attempted, successfully in the end, to halt the free fall. But then once that was, you know, achieved, at least in the short term, you know, business as usual resumed. The finance sector wasn't reformed. None of the underlying structural problems in the system have been dealt with. And as for, you know, the philosophy or the ideology of neoliberalism, well, rumours of its death turned out to be greatly exaggerated. I have to admit, I was one of those who wrote an article, the height of the financial crash in 2008, claiming, you know, that the economics departments of universities have to shred all of their textbooks, all that contained orthodox economics. Well, I think, you know, if any of them did follow my advice at the time. I'm not sure they did, yeah. Well, they put some of the pages back together. You know, not the ones about the mystical powers of the invisible hand, but definitely the chapters on the virtues of structural adjustment programs, cuts to social spending, liberalisation of labour markets, and so on, because all those things are very much now back in fashion. So, you know, in the wake of the crisis, we've seen not a new strategy at all, but an acceleration of the policies pursued by governments around the world since the late 1970s. Cuts to social spending, cuts to wages, slashing public sector jobs, all aimed at overcoming the debt crisis caused by 30 years of precisely these same policies. And, you know, the ruling class of the world is pretty much united, unanimous in their support for this approach. No leading figure anywhere is proposing anything different. You know, Obama, for all his election rhetoric, has essentially continued on with the policies adopted by Bush in the last months of his presidency. And because of this, I think, there's very little space for a new, you know, Roosevelt-like figure who stands up against particular capitalists and pursues a restructuring of the system in the interests of the ruling class as a whole, something that in the right circumstances could galvanise popular and working class support. And so the only alternative today is to actually resist the agenda of the ruling establishment. But for the Social Democrats, of course, you know, such an idea is a total anathema. And, you know, there's no modern-day Roosevelt among American liberalism. There's even less a modern-day Jack Lang in the ranks of social democracy. Lang, for people who don't know, was the populist Labor Premier of New South Wales who, in the 1930s, refused to pay the interest on government debt to British banks and suffered as a result savage backlash from the rich and powerful who, you know, accused him of wanting to bring Bolshevism to New South Wales. Good idea if he had, but unfortunately not. But today, you know, no one like that. You know, the Social Democrats, loyal servants of the system, thoroughly domesticated by capital. Even the most timid stance in defence of their working class supporters is beyond them. Now, of course, while the scale of social democracy's fawning before capital, I think, is new, betrayals, obviously, by the reformists are not. You know, in 1930, the Prime Minister James Scullin launched a savage attack on wages, Labor Prime Minister, savage attack on wages and social spending in an attempt to push the cost of the Depression onto workers. He cut government spending by 20%, public service wages by 10%. You know, the 1974 recession, the Whitlam Labor Prime Minister sacked his reforming treasurer, Jim Cairns, replaced him with a conservative, Bill Hayden, you know, the prelude to a real ramping up of an attack on working class living standards. But in the past, these betrayals by the reformists met substantial opposition from the left and from the unions. And really, that's what is needed again today. But in many countries, the trade unions have refused to lead a serious fight back. And two of the worst examples are the United States and, unfortunately, Australia. Here, the unions have done nothing to oppose Rudd's industrial laws or to provide a left-wing alternative in society more broadly. The ACTU leaders in particular have distinguished themselves by praising Rudd's workplace legislation, you know, promoting the illusion that Labor's dismantled work choices. Sharon Burrow, on the day of the Fair Work Act, so-called, came into effect, said, well, it's a great day for Australian workers. We'll be celebrating. Workers across the country will be celebrating the death of work choices. Well, you know, if only. But, of course, not all of the union leaders have been quite as craven as that. You know, the construction unions have campaigned against the continuation of what they call Gillard's Gestapo, the ABCC. And, you know, there's been plenty of verbal stoushes between Gillard in particular and the more left-wing union officials. But there is a world of difference between mouthing off and fighting back. And the reality is that there's been no significant attempt by the unions to organise actual resistance to Labor's agenda. And this passivity reflects the political problems that have undermined Australian unionism for some decades now. In 1984, the unions, with the right in an alliance with the Communist Party, broke the back of rank-and-file organisation and union militancy by accepting what was known as the Accord, an agreement between the Labor government and the unions to curb strikes in exchange, supposedly, for real wage rises. Now, of course, real wages fell in the next decade, but the unions held up their end of the bargain, transforming themselves into little more than lobby groups, you know, forgetting how to go on strike, disavowing union militancy, destroying the rank-and-file organisation that existed as a result of the 1970s. And under John Howard's Liberal government, who never would have thought to try and co-opt the union leaders, they found that they had very much lost the habit of class struggle. Even the campaign they did run against work choices was transformed into an electoral project to put Labor back into power. So I think it's a little surprise that under Rudd today, the unions have so eroded their organisation at the base, so accepted their position as questioners of government policy rather than fighters for working class interests, that total acquiescence does not even provoke an outraged reaction from those on the so-called left of the trade union movement. But in terms of the crisis, one important factor in Australia, of course, is that, you know, the recession hasn't yet hit here hard. I think if you look at the US, you get a fuller picture of the impact of union passivity in the face of economic calamity. Over the past 18 months, there's been a wave of union concessions in the United States, epitomised by the United Auto Workers Agreement to eliminate tens of thousands of jobs, slash benefits, and give up decades of work rules. In the public sector, where workers have faced wage cuts of more than 10% in scores of cities and communities across the US, the unions have agreed to most of these cuts. And even in the past few months, as, you know, the worst of the initial collapse seemed to have passed, concessions from the unions continued. For example, I was reading just the other day about the example of the International Association of Machinists, who recently agreed to the elimination of half of 2,000 jobs, union jobs, at a Harley-Davidson plant in Pennsylvania. So a pretty grim situation. It's not as bad everywhere, though. In Europe, there have been significant struggles. France has seen several general strikes over the past period, and important industrial action by air traffic controllers or refinery workers just over the past month or so. In Germany, 4,500 pilots were on strike in March. Spain, where unemployment is now over 4 million, has seen strikes and workers' demonstrations in the last few weeks. In Britain, there's been at least the beginnings of more significant union action. British Airways staff, as people might have seen, have just been on strike for the second time against attacks, you know, like everywhere, on jobs, on pay and on their conditions. And of course, in Greece, as we've covered in our magazine and on our website, there's been a wave of mass strikes against austerity measures, which have seen millions on strike in what is really the key battleground in the class struggle across Europe. So because of all of these things, the UK Independent newspaper warned that the eruption of strikes and protests across Europe heralded the biggest wave of rebellion experienced on the continent since the revolutionary upheavals of 1968. But unfortunately, there have been serious limitations to the union response. The French CGT union threatened fire and blood, they said, after oil giant Total announced the closure of its refinery in Dunkirk. But it then called off the national oil refinery strike, capitulating to the company's plans to close the facility. The German pilots' union called off the strike I referred to earlier on its first day. And at the same time, Germany's two biggest trade unions, the engineering and the industrial union and the public sector union, agreed to extend contracts for their 5 million members that are going to impose real wage cuts. In Britain, the union representing the British Airways workers, Unite, is trying to dampen down the growing momentum of the strike campaign. The latest thing declaring it's not going to have any more action for at least a few more weeks. And even in Greece, where the scale of the rebellion has been much greater, the unions have been had to be very reluctantly drawn into the fight. The private sector General Confederation of Greek Workers, which is tied to the ruling Socialist Party, tried to call off the March 11 general strike and only backed down under intense pressure. As Antonis Devanellos explained in his article featured on our website a week or two ago, the Social Democratic trade union leaders have been doing everything they can to try and contain the struggle in Greece. I think these hesitations reflect two connected problems. One, the social position of the trade union leaders, whose first instinct, because of their role as negotiators between labour and capital, their first instinct is to try and find a compromise. And second, the fact that most of the union leaders are tied either explicitly or implicitly to the social democratic parties, or in some countries to communist parties or similar, who act really as the left wing of social democracy and collaborate with it. So what's needed to take the struggle forward is both rank-and-file workers' organisations independent of the union officials and the building of political parties who are determined not to compromise with capital and with social democracy, but actually to stand up and fight them. Now, so far, there's only the most embryonic forms of independent working-class industrial organisation. And in terms of a political alternative to take on the social democrat betrayals, the left has had limited success. In most countries, it hasn't been able to break through. The two most important exceptions in recent years, if you include going back a couple of years before the crisis, have been Communist Refoundation in Italy and Die Linke in Germany. But the experience of these parties unfortunately raises considerable problems as well. At its height, several years ago, Refoundation in Italy had tens of thousands of members, you know, a whole series of MPs, and an important presence in the trade unions. And after playing a positive role in campaigns against pension cuts and against the war in Iraq, Refoundation swung sharply to the right and joined the centre-left coalition government. In government, Refoundation voted for Italian participation in the Afghanistan war and for a range of anti-worker policies domestically. And this led, really, you know, to the collapse. The massive disillusionment amongst membership, the vote went down. It got just 3% in the elections and lost, you know, pretty much all of its MPs. The German Left Party, Die Linke, has grown up in influence more recently in a way over the last few years. In the last elections, its vote rose to 11.9%, which is quite significant. When combined with the Green vote in Germany, they actually, did they outpoll? I think it was almost equal to the vote that was received by the SPD. And, you know, the party there now has a whole number of parliamentarians. Now, Die Linke claims to be a party committed to class struggle politics, but alongside its strategy of organising resistance through the unions and through street campaigns and so on, many in the party are looking towards a future governmental partnership with the Social Democrats, the SPD. If in a coalition government, the Link would have to play its part in carrying out sharp attacks. And this already happened, actually, in Berlin, where the party rules with the SPD, which has led to a dramatic loss of support there. But in spite of that experience, Die Linke and the SPD formed a government in the federal state of Brandenburg, and the SPD, you know, predictably dictated the terms, forcing through a decision to cut the number of workers employed in public services from the current 51,000 to 40,000 over the next few years. So quite a significant cut. So in both of these cases, the problem is that while these parties broke with the Social Democrats to the left, or, you know, stood to the left of them, they still aimed at forming some kind of, you know, grouping with the mainstream Social Democrats. And this meant taking responsibility for the running of the bourgeois state. Now, this would be bad enough at the best of times, really. But I think as the experience of social democracy in power over the last 30 years has shown, in contemporary capitalism, there is less room than ever before to extract concessions for the system. And this is going to only become more starkly the case over the next few years as the crisis continues. Now, it can't be ruled out that more determined fighting reformist parties will emerge over the next few years, either through splits in social democracy or through entirely new formations emerging. But I think we have to say that the whole economic and political situation makes this kind of development quite unlikely. And even if such parties do emerge, they will not have much time or space before they have to confront fundamental questions about their attitude to the state and to capital and work out if they're going to follow the road of compromise or of struggle. Okay, so given the weakness of the far left internationally and the difficulties the few groups with any substantial support, like the French Anti-Capitalist Party, the MPA, the difficulties they've had in going from, you know, groups of a few thousand to organisations with mass influence, well, you could be forgiven for drawing, you know, quite pessimistic conclusions from this picture. But I don't think that pessimism would be justified. The combination of the scale of the economic crisis and the connected crisis of US imperialism, the fact that we can expect the crisis to drag out for many years, and as well the scale of working class resistance and bitterness that we've already seen in a number of countries, all of this, I think, creates a highly volatile political situation. And historically, there are any number of examples, particularly in times of acute crisis in the system, of revolts that have taken place in spite of the betrayals of the existing forces and in spite of the weakness of the far left. One example, you know, the revolt in Germany at the end of World War I. There, you know, a struggle of revolutionary proportions broke out in spite of the fact that the communists there had, you know, very little influence at all and couldn't really impact events. I think more recently of the radicalisation in the 1960s that, you know, a whole series of countries relied on the development of entirely new forces in the course of the struggle. Or even think on a smaller scale of the campaign, some people here might remember, to defend the MUA, the Maritime Union, in Australia 12 years ago. In the face of a determined effort by the Howard government to smash the union, thousands of people, you know, overnight almost, joined pickets and protests for week after week that paralysed Howard's offensive and saved the MUA. You know, almost overnight, went from a situation where everyone was saying, oh, you know, class struggles, history, and all of a sudden, class struggle politics came to the fore in Australia in a way that they hadn't since the 1970s. And today, aside from the struggles I've mentioned in Europe, there are important battles taking place across the world. Though they haven't had a significant impact here, there's been major class confrontations in China, in Egypt, in South Africa, and Venezuela, amongst many other countries. And even in the US, where the level of union struggle is extremely low, we've seen over the past few months an extraordinary movement of teachers and of students opposing cutbacks in California that has drawn tens of thousands of people into quite militant and determined political action. So I think it's such outbursts that create the possibility of a broader fight back and, over time, the construction of a new radical left. But it's not enough simply to look with enthusiasm to the struggles generated by the crisis. In an economic downturn where the economic bargaining power of the working class is weak and the ruthlessness of the capitalist class is at its high point, it is impossible to go beyond a certain point without serious politics. And I think this is really one of the lessons from the 1970s in Australia, where for all the industrial militancy of the workers' movement, it could not cope with the political questions raised by the end of the boom and government demands for austerity. So, we don't know how things are going to develop here over the next period. But I think we can point to some of the key political positions that will be necessary if a left capable of confronting the crisis is to be built. First, in Australia in particular, the left needs to be rebuilt on the basis of working class politics. In countries like here, this necessitates a sharp break from the previous period where the main perceived left alternative to Labor has been the Greens. The rise of the Greens reflected in a way the political questions that have dominated politics for most of the last two decades, racism in its various forms and Australia's backing for the US wars in the Middle East. So the Greens, you know, middle-class liberal politics were never anti-imperialist, but they took a sufficiently anti-war, anti-racist stance to be able to benefit from the movements against the Iraq war for refugee rights and so on. But we have to be blunt, the Greens have nothing to offer today in the face of economic crisis and class polarisation. They don't see the world in class terms at all. They don't see the primary divide in society as being between the owners and the producers of wealth. They have no orientation to organising along class lines, to organising workers. And this is reflected actually in the role that they played in the union campaign at the end of the Howard era. While they did say they were against work choices and had reasonable policies and so on, their campaign consisted of almost entirely just an electoral strategy. Their solution to the inadequacies of the ALP was to get themselves elected to the Senate. So while the Greens have many individual backers in the union movement, they did not use this support to pose an industrial alternative to the dominant ALP-aligned leadership of the unions. They had nothing to say about union strategy or about any of the debates in the labour movement. They did nothing to intervene, for example, in the mass meetings of delegates that took place here in Melbourne during the campaign. Did nothing to intervene arguing for an industrial action, for mass strikes to defeat the laws and so on. Instead, it was left to small groups of socialists to argue at these meetings for an alternative to the elect labour strategy. And since the crisis has hit, the Greens have been almost silent, or almost silent. Maybe it would have been better if they were totally silent, because the one contribution they have made has been to attack the Rudd government for the scale of its emergency spending, essentially lining up with the Liberals in demanding, you know, fiscal responsibility, a balanced budget, and so on. So we need organisations with working class politics, but as the experience in Italy and Germany, I think, shows, just having a working class party that's to the left of social democracy also isn't enough. We need to build organisations that actually fight for a class struggle strategy in the working class. What does this mean? Well, not only are refusing to participate in governments, which will inevitably be forced to implement a tax on workers and social spending, but it also means we need parties that can combat the political arguments that are put forward for accepting compromises in, you know, the national interests, or because bosses or governments can't afford to grant union demands or pull back from cuts. The capitalist class, people might have noticed, do not consider the interests of the whole society before they lay off workers, grant themselves millions of dollars in bonuses and so on. They think about themselves. And we need a similar hard-headed partisan class approach. We need organisations that will fight for working class interests regardless of what that means for the capitalist system, for the national economy. If capitalism cannot provide the basics of life for the workers who produce all of its wealth, well, that is an indictment of the capitalist system and justification for overthrowing it. It is not a reason for workers to accept cutbacks to jobs, losing their pensions and so on. Okay, so to start to finish up, Australia can seem very isolated from the turmoil that's rocking the world system, and there's no denying that for now that's largely the case. But as I've said, and people went to Tom's talk yesterday would have heard, the crisis in the world system is deep-rooted and systemic. The policies of the ruling classes of the world may have succeeded in stopping the initial freefall, but they've done nothing to address the underlying problems in the system. The outbreaks of attacks on the one hand and resistance on the other that we've seen, particularly in Europe in the last few months, really, I think, prefigure what is to come. You know, China today is hailed as the saviour of the Australian economy, and there's some truth to that at the moment at least. But Chinese society is racked by internal divisions and contradictions, in many ways, or some ways at least, It resembles Russia in the lead-up to the 1905 revolution with its repressive political system, you know, straining under pressure from within and without, its fast-paced industrial revolution, its combination of advanced industry with political and economic backwardness, its rising level of economic rebellion from workers and peasants. Now, of course, we don't know where the ruptures that will transform the situation here will come from. Might be from China, might be from somewhere totally unexpected. But we do know that Australia, we live in an integrated world economy, and Australia will not be immune from its convulsions forever. And indeed, it's not the exception, but really it's the norm historically for rebellion and revolution to be exported. Without the French Revolution, would capitalism have come to dominate Europe? Without the Russian Revolution, would the German Kaiser have been overthrown? You know, without the radicalisation in the United States, would Europe and Australia in particular have erupted in revolt as they did in 1968? So we can expect turmoil in the future, but we can't predict is whether there will be the forces on the ground in Australia to turn outrage into revolt, let alone revolt into revolution. Whether that happens, I think, depends very much on the political line taken by the radical wing of the struggle, and whether that line can win the day against all the ideas and all the arguments that are arrayed in defence of moderation and collaboration. And that's why building a socialist organisation today, an organisation that stands unequivocally for class struggle politics and uncompromising hostility to the system of capitalist rule, is so crucial. Because if, when the opportunity to do so arises, the Australian left is to be rebuilt on a mass scale and on a basis that makes it capable of seriously threatening the capitalist elite in this country, then I think it's going to have revolutionary socialist politics at its core. I finish there.